Hey there, Freaky Fam, and welcome to another episode of Mads, Monsters, and Maniacs. I'm your host, Mads. If you are new here, Mads, Monsters, Maniacs is a true crime podcast slash like a horror podcast where we talk about all things true crime and spooky. So if you're into that thing, go ahead and keep on listening. I honestly feel like it's been ages since I've gotten to sit down and talk to you guys. I know in reality it's only been about a week, but I don't know, this last week kind of dragged on. I don't really have much to talk about before we get started. I went thrift shopping with my sister and my niece yesterday, and let me tell you guys about some of the shirts that I found. They are fantastic. I found one shirt that has two cowboy skeletons on it at a bar, and it says, "It just goes right through me." And I thought it was so funny, I had to buy it. It was only like $4, so. And then I found this amazing sweatshirt. Okay, I do this all the time where you find something that you like the color or you like the pattern, and then you reveal it and it has some stupid ass shit written on it. And then you're so devastated. Well, this one, it's this amazing sweatshirt. I knew the moment I saw it, I was like, I need that. And then I read it and it says, "Michigan Marching Band Mom." And I laughed so hard, and don't you worry, I did buy it. So yes, I am now a Michigan marching band mom. I can't wait for my new life. So really, other than that, we're just gonna go ahead and hop into this week's episode. I do want to go ahead and add a trigger warning on this episode. There are brief mentions of rape, mutilation, child abuse, and child sexual assault. So just be wary of that if you do decide to continue on. This week, we're going to be talking about the Ant Hill Kids cult. And I have definitely heard of this one, but I didn't know how disgustingly awful it truly was. I'm still just so astonished by it. It's a whole different level of cult behaviors and just what actually happens to the members. It's nothing like anything that we've covered thus far. Just be prepared. It is a lot. And as I said, that there is a trigger warning on this episode. So as we know, most cults brainwash their members, essentially steal money from them, and end up ending in murder, mass murders, or mass suicide packs. But this cult, it's not really that different, but their leader is most definitely on a different level of sadism and feeding that ego. So we're going to go ahead and meet him. Also, bear with me, this does take place in Canada, but it's in the French Canadian. So the pronunciations are, of course, going to be more French. So bear with me. Rose Terriel was born on May 16th, 1947, in a small Canadian mining town in Quebec. His family grew up poor, and his mother claimed that his father was incredibly abusive towards Roche throughout his childhood, although his father would deny the allegations. Roche was described as all of the basics of every other cult leader that we know of. He was charismatic, well-read, all around a great student, but he did end up dropping out of school when he was 13 years old. And this is kind of when he started really getting into religion. So his family had raised him Catholic, and they belonged to a movement called the Pilgrims of St. Michael. They were also known as the White Berets because of these hats that they wore while going door to door to hand out pamphlets about their church and their mission to create a more Christian society. They would create this culture by forming a more equitable class structure and disbanding powerful banks in the area. Roche hated doing this with his family, which ended up creating a deep hatred for the Catholic Church. By the early 1970s, Roche had filed for bankruptcy and was out of work. He had a wife and two children to care for, and I really couldn't find any information about how they met or when they got married. But Roche at some point had surgery for an ulcer, but ended up dealing with a lot of abdominal pain and digestive issues afterwards. He then began obsessing over information about medicine and religion and ended up joining the Seventh-day Adventist Church. I found that to be so interesting because the amount of cult leaders that have been a part of this specific religion is shocking to me. Like, they need to chill out. Like, there's a pattern here. But I will go ahead and kind of give a refresher on this religion. It's a Protestant religion that has apocalyptic roots. They encourage a vegetarian eating style and clean living, like no smoking, no drinking, no eating processed foods, that sort of thing. Roche's charming demeanor and humor impressed the church leaders, which ended up leading him to be in charge of a class at the church on how to quit smoking soon after he joined. It is unclear, I didn't find any information, if he was previously a smoker, so I kind of think that that's very comical if he wasn't. He's teaching a class about how to quit smoking, but like was never a smoker. I don't know. Of course, this didn't last long because the leadership soon went to his head and church leaders found his behavior to be arrogant and they ended up kicking him out of the church. In one of the sources I found, it said that they also kicked him out of the church because he was trying to take over leadership. But before actually being removed from the church, he did manage to take a few members with him. He had gone to a church retreat where he recruited a few members, and most of these members were trying to get clean from drugs or alcohol abuse, so he really preyed on them. One member that ended up leaving with him was previously a nurse that had turned to stripping to fuel her drug addiction, and of course they met at the retreat. She had a dream several nights before about a man that looked like Roche, and she said that she knew she had a higher purpose. Once she met him, she felt as if it was fate that had made them cross paths. Now, Roche, of course, had connections to speak to Daddy God himself. So around this time, he was creating a natural healing center and asked this woman to join him, claiming it would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to serve others. So doing more research into this natural healing center, it's completely idiotic. Like, it's described as an alternative to alternative type of place. Like, they would serve this grape juice prescription that was supposedly supposed to help cure leukemia, which ended up leading to this woman's death because she was trusting them and drinking this juice to cure her leukemia. And obviously it did not. And unfortunately, she did pass away from leukemia. By 1978, God told Roche that he had a different path for him and that the end was coming. God was, though, he was generous enough to let him know the exact date it was going to be going down on, which was February 17th, 1978. In case you believe in this, hello, it is currently 2021. I know, what can I say? We made it. Roche truly believed that he was a prophet, and he basically created this new goal that he needed to create a free-thinking commune where all of these people could listen to his teaching, live as equals, and he forced his followers to abandon their homes, abandon their families after convincing them that the world and their loved ones were all corrupt. Roche believed that his group and himself would be able to survive the apocalypse if they moved to a forest area, and that he would be responsible for rebuilding the world. I feel like they could have picked a better man with some better genes, but that's just me. Roche took a group of 9 women, 4 men, and a few children to eastern Quebec to prepare for the end of the world. When they started clearing the thick woods, this is kind of when Roche started calling his members the Anthill Kids because of their hard work. In one of the other sources that I found, it said that he actually didn't label them the Anthill Kids until they moved to their second location because it was kind of like on top of a hill, and with their hard work, he thought of them as ants and the anthill kind of thing. So I just wanted to include that in there as well. So while they begin building their communal log cabin, they were living in tents at the time. And this is kind of when all the brainwashing first started. We already know he's a prophet. So, I mean, there's already some sort of brainwashing going on. But this is when it got a little more intense. Like, the group would be up at 5 a.m. daily. They would hike to their cars to retrieve food. And because of their diet, it usually consisted of raw vegetables. So they already weren't getting a lot of nutrients. I'm not saying if you're a vegetarian that you're not powerful and strong. You get it. But I mean, if they're just eating vegetables, they're not eating anything else for like proteins and different things like that. And they're also rationing their foods because A, the apocalypse is among us. And B, like there's all these people. They don't have like a wide variety of food, so they're having to ration it for all these other people and for throughout the day. So they're starting to get severely malnourished, but you know, not eating, it does do things to your mind. So members later said that they were so focused on if they were gonna have enough food for dinner that they barely noticed the changes in Roche's behavior. He would start lecturing the members throughout the night on the corruption within us in society and the evilness in conventional families. So mind you, they get up at 5 a.m. every day and then they're not eating properly and then they're staying up at all hours of the night to hear all of this bullshit being spewed. So yeah, I would go a little crazy too. Roche and his followers began living accordingly to his personal representation of the Bible, and they basically started accepting him as their own God, which, as we know, the delusions only grow and grow at this point. He then would force members to tell stories of their childhoods, and he did this to basically isolate members from their families and their parents by saying that their parents couldn't give them good things only come from him. So he's already setting it up as, I talked to God, but now here I am surpassing God. God doesn't give you what you need. Your parents don't give you what you need. Allegedly, only he gives you what you need. After they had finished the cabin, Roche decided that each member needed a new name. So naturally, he chose something biblical for each of them, giving himself the new name of Moses. When settling in, members started to notice that Roche was not sticking to their rules of clean eating. He was eating meat, drinking soda, and eating processed foods like chips. It was also apparent that he didn't seem to have really any moral compass or like what their next steps were while they wait. So Roche was getting these foods because local residents were donating all of these like processed foods and everything to the group, and he even ended up forcing one of his members into sex work with a local shopkeeper in exchange for supplies. Later that year, Roche's wife was about 6 months pregnant, and he decided that now would be a great time to start taking on spiritual wives. He started quoting the biblical story of King David and how David went on to have 7 more wives and concubines. This went on for several months until they decided to go to Utah and have a marriage ceremony for many of his wives. And because this man is literal trash and the epitome of a toxic male, he started pitting his wives against each other to fight for his attention. This man is literally gross. Like, there's nothing appealing about him whatsoever. I will post the photos online so you guys can see. Like, this man is so gross looking. I mean, they always are, but like, so gross. Now, of course, February 17th, 1978, came and then went, and the world just kept on trucking. So Roche had to come up with a theory for his members. He had to tell them what was going on. So, you know, he just had to go have a private chat with Daddy God, and he came back to them and told them that God has a different time clock than mere mortals. Then why the fuck would he give you the date? In another source, it did say that Roche did not consult God because he was the one who created the date and time, but he ultimately decided it was because the Israeli calendar was different from the Roman calendar, so that's why the dates didn't line up. The group then accepted this explanation, but they still stayed cautious of their leader. His mood swings were deepening, especially because he had started drinking heavily. He disciplined the children by pinning them against a tree with a knife and instructing their mothers to throw rocks at them. And then he worked his followers ragged to create his vision of a divine existence, which of course would mean that he was subjecting them to his teaching and drunken rages. So this all went on for about 2 years, and that's when the group experienced their first death, or of course I would call it a murder. Now there are like two different stories about it, so I'm gonna begin with the first one and then I will tell you the second one. They are similar, things are just slightly out of order. So on March 23rd, 1981, 2-year-old Samuel Geiger would not stop crying. His parents were out working in the woods that day, and Samuel was being watched by a man named Guy Veer. Guy was basically the guy that was in charge of babysitting while parents were away working. Each time Guy would start drifting into sleep, Samuel would begin crying again. So Guy only thought that there was one way to make him stop, and he hit Samuel in the face more than 4 times to make him stop crying. You are a grown ass man. Are you fucking kidding me? They had a resident nurse at the compound. She's the same one. Her name's Gabrielle. She is from the beginning. They met at the retreat. And over the next few days, she testified that Samuel was unable to sit up on his own or eat solid foods. 2 days after the beating, she noticed that Samuel was having complications with urinating due to swelling on his genitals. Roche came in and ended up making an incision to drain the lump, and then they applied a paste that was made up of iodine, olive oil, and plantain. The next day, Samuel was so sick that he had to be fed fluids a drop at a time. Samuel died 3 days after he had been beaten. And this is where it gets even more fucking crazy to me. His parents and Roche decided to burn Samuel's remains so that way he would not be eaten by animals if they buried him outside. Like, this is your fucking kid. I already know that I would have beat the shit out of anyone who took away my child's life. Are you fucking kidding me? Now, there is another theory of what actually happened. Now, that is the story that they told authorities, because don't worry, there were charges filed. Unfortunately, they obviously didn't keep him locked up for long, but this is basically what is thought to have happened. It's believed that Roche was giving Samuel a circumcision, and after the so-called surgery, Samuel of course would not stop crying, and that's when Roche ordered one of his followers, Guy Veer, to beat the little boy, who then died of his injuries. Then there was also like another little story that was believed that he died because Roche gave him too much alcohol and it ended up poisoning him. It's very back and forth with what actually happened, unfortunately, but either way, that should have never happened, ever. It's a fucking child. Number one, everyone knows kids cry. Hell, I'm 23, I cry all the time. So because of this incident, Guy was later castrated by Roche, and Roche told his followers that if anybody asked, it was because Guy had been trampled by horses. It's kind of a stretch, but okay. So Guy ended up escaping the cult and told a neighbor about Samuel's death. Police showed up and arrested Roche, Samuel's parents, and then they found Guy a couple days later and arrested him as well. They were all found criminally responsible for Samuel's death. But as I was saying, like most cases, Roche wasn't kept behind bars for long. But during his imprisonment, he would call his wives regularly and was remorseful and made claims that once he was out, their group would be more peaceful going forward. He was released 2 fucking years later. Like, that was it. 2 years. It doesn't seem known what the group was doing while Roche was in prison, but once he was out, the group reassembled and moved to 200 acres of land outside of Burnt River, Ontario. Is it Ontario or Ontario? Now, I'm sure you all guessed that things went back to normal pretty quickly after his return, even with the authorities keeping an eye on them. They went back.
So his followers began being able to support themselves by making maple syrup, preserves, bread, and smoking fish. Around this time, it appeared that the commune was beginning to mesh really well within the community, but Roche had begun drinking heavily, and as his drinking increased, so did his violence. He began exerting control over his followers to basically get them to be too weak, both physically and mentally, so then they couldn't escape. He started forbidding them from speaking to each other without his permission and conducted what he would call gladiator tournaments. And basically these tournaments, he would force his followers into a dirt ring and force them to fight. He became increasingly paranoid that his followers were thinking of defecting and became even more violent. So he would also hit his followers with belts and soon introduce hammers and the flat side of an axe. If Roche felt that a follower was thinking about leaving, he would suspend them from the ceiling and pluck out their hairs one by one before defecating on them. And he even had followers prove their loyalty by breaking their own legs with sledgehammers. He also would order his followers to sit on lit stoves, shoot each other in the shoulder, smear feces on one another, and cut off each other's toes. He also took to sexually abusing his followers and forcing them to eat their own feces. Unfortunately, it just gets darker from here. Even the children were being abused sexually and physically. They would be stripped naked and whipped if one of them allegedly misbehaved. Roche would even nail them to a tree and force other children to throw rocks at them.
The following year, when a 5-month-old baby died at the commune, the coroner ruled that the death was due to sudden infant death syndrome. But the mother said that the baby actually died after Roche ordered the newborn to be wrapped in a blanket and put out in a wheelbarrow for hours in the dead of winter as a cruel punishment for crying. It's a newborn baby. You can't even survive out like that in the winter. And it's a newborn fucking baby. Again, of course they're gonna cry. Don't have sex if you don't want a kid and you don't want it to cry. Wear a condom. Like, you just think that you're gonna have a baby and it's just miraculously never gonna cry?
I don't understand why they would continuously respect and defend this man. Like, this is a newborn fucking baby and you're telling me that absolutely nobody stepped in to stop it? I would have fucking dipped after Samuel.
In late 1985, Children's Aid Society, a government-approved child welfare agency, was tipped off that child abuse was happening at the commune. A raid led to 13 children being placed in foster care. The following year, an independent child abuse expert named Dr. Martine Milkovich evaluated 8 of the children aged 3 to 9 who had been removed from their parents at Burnt River. She heard unbelievable accounts that the children had assisted with births, watched adults have sex, and had sexual contact with each other. Milkovich recommended that the children be allowed back in the care of Roche. What the fuck? He already had one criminal charge for the death of Samuel, and after finding out all of this information, you decide that they would be in better care with this man? Jail. Jail for you. In a report, she said, "There was a different kind of naive attitude that you have to expose children to these things because they are a part of nature. Certainly, the children were allowed to have sexual activities among themselves, but the principles behind it weren't bad." Bitch, number one, they are ages 3 to 9. Not only that, maybe you should save those children and maybe you should go be a part of the cult. Maybe you should deal with that instead. She also said in a report how Roche demonstrated masturbating in front of the children, but believed it was important because he wasn't doing it for satisfaction. He was doing it for educational purposes, and she thought it was important that there's a difference between the two. Are you shitting me? Luckily, the judge had some sense. The judge did not take her advice and feared for the safety of the children, and so he made them wards of the crown, and the children were placed with adoptive families. Thank God someone had some sense here. She needed her license fucking revoked.
The children's aid also were basically just trying to save the children. They weren't interested in seeking justice. So that's why no charges had been filed on them at the time. So the commune continued with 2 men and 8 women. After the children were removed, Roche started to become even more violent, if you can believe that. While he was drinking all the time, he basically started believing he was a doctor who could perform absolutely any medical act on his followers. There was one evening that he placed a rubber band around the testicles of one follower, and of course the scrotum became swollen and infected after around 8 hours, and Roche removed the testicle and basically sealed the wound with a hot iron. In September of 1988, he ordered Solange Boilliard onto the kitchen table and stripped her naked. Earlier that day, she had complained about having a sore stomach, so he punched her in the stomach and then shoved a plastic tube up her rectum, performing an enema with molasses and olive oil. He then made an incision on the side of her abdomen and pulled out a section of her intestines with his bare hands. He then ripped a piece of the intestine out and stuffed the rest back into her abdomen. Boilliard was then stitched back up, and she did remain alive and in agony until the next day when she passed, most likely because of the digestive chemicals leaking into her abdominal cavity. This next part is just absolutely crazy. Because Roche then claimed that he had the ability of resurrection, and he ordered his followers to dig Boilliard back up and then remove her uterus and saw off a portion of her skull so that he could masturbate into her brain and bring her back to life. This is very Dahmer for me. However, she obviously did not resurrect. So he then instead ordered his followers to bury her body on the grounds of the commune, but first he removed one of her ribs and kept it in a leather case around his neck. In November of 1988, another member, Gabrielle, complained that she had a toothache. Roche responded by ripping out a number of her teeth with pliers. Later that night, he chased her with a knife and cut the tendon of one of her hands. In July of 1989, Roche impaled Gabrielle's hand on the kitchen table after she complained of stiffness in the hand. He then decided that he needed to amputate her arm. He grabbed a meat cleaver and hacked her arm off. She laid in agony on the kitchen floor until the stump was stitched up the following morning. There was another source that said that he had asked her to write down, basically like telling him how great he was and all that other stuff to feed his ego, and she couldn't do that. So he impaled her hand with the knife into the table and began carving up her arm, and she had been convinced that he was going to kill her that night, and then he took her outside and amputated her arm with an axe. And then stitched her up with twine and then burned the remaining portion of her arm. A couple weeks later, on August 16th, Gabrielle managed to escape the commune. She hitchhiked to a hospital north of Toronto and unleash the disturbing truth of what was going behind at the commune. It is also said that Roche's legal wife, Giselle, was the one that confided in a welfare caseworker about the horrors that were going on at the commune. A few weeks later, Roche was picked up on assault charges for Gabrielle, along with a few other members, as accomplices. At the time, Roche had no idea that they knew anything about the murder of Solange, so he pled guilty to the assault on Gabrielle. About a year later, in December of 1990, Roche had been charged with second-degree murder for Solange Boilliard. Anticipating that Roche's lawyer might try to have his client's murder charge bumped down to manslaughter because he was drunk during the incident, Constable Bob Bowen decided that he needed to gather as much information and evidence as possible about additional crimes to have the cult leader deemed a dangerous offender by the courts. Bowen diligently interviewed Roche's victims, collecting enough information and evidence to prove that the cult leader was responsible for at least 84 attacks. America could never. When the investigation came to light, Roche's lawyer got him a plea deal. He pled guilty to second-degree murder, and they did this to show it was not premeditated, but it did have a stipulation in there that the assaults would not be prosecuted. Because they did this, most of his other behaviors were not entered in as public record. He was sentenced to life in prison in 1993. Roche's life in prison consisted of writing poems, working on his art, and continuing to father children with three of his wives who stuck by him. These wives were named Francine, Chantel, and Nicole. And even though he was behind bars at the time, the girls moved into neighboring log cabins about a half mile away from Millhaven Institution, which was a maximum security prison where he was being held at the time. The women ran a bakery, and Francine waited for her turn for a conjugal visit with Roche, which rolled around about every 6 weeks. She then gave birth to their fifth child, which would have been his 28th, while he was behind bars. 13 years into his sentence, Roche came up before the parole board for the first time. Although he had applied for parole, he asked the board not to release him from prison because he feared for his safety outside of the penitentiary's gates. Like, okay, so you applied for parole to ask to not receive parole? That's great, because we're not going to fucking give it to you. So of course they didn't. They cited his drug and alcohol problems and deemed him a danger to society. Gabrielle was at the hearing, and she said in an interview with CBC News, "This man is very subtle, extremely manipulative. He's a psychopath. To me, to my eyes, he's a psychopath. You can see my face. I'm so glad. I'm really, really, really glad." On the morning of February 26, 2011, convicted murderer Matthew Gerard MacDonald entered Roche's cell and stabbed him in the neck with a shank, killing him. According to the article Canadian Messiah, apparently MacDonald had a big problem with Roche's treatment of women and children, and later confessed to prison guards that he had sliced him up. Roche died at 63 years old. And that is the story of the Ant Hill Kids cult. I really didn't expect it to be this heavy this week. We might have to do something a lot less heavy next week. I'll look into that for you. But I'm just so astonished. I used to think that I had a very impressionable mind, and that if I would have lived in these time periods, I most definitely would have somehow joined a cult. That's me. I'm like, okay, yeah, sounds good. Yeah, let's make us all equal, you know? But this would not be one of them. I would have hightailed my happy ass out of there. No, ma'am. And I fully understand that they were probably scared shitless. I mean, what do you do in that situation? It must have been terrifying and even more terrifying to get out, especially if they were believing everything he was saying about the apocalypse and how it's coming and how he's God and all that other bullshit. I cannot even begin to imagine what they were going through. There was also one more thing that I wanted to talk about before hopping off here. So apparently before Roche had been killed, he was in the headlines once again for his artwork that was discovered on a Murderabilia website, which of course was headquartered in the fucking United States, and it was called murderauction.com. So here in the U.S., we have the Son of Sam laws that make it difficult for criminals to profit from crimes through book and TV deals and different things like that. But Canada didn't have anything equivalent to that at the time. The following year, prison officials found a workaround which basically made it to where Roche's poems and artwork weren't able to leave the prison. But at the time, there were some items that had made it onto the site and that they remained for sale. And like the listing bids are honestly just fucking outrageous. Like one item was $100. There was a Polaroid of what appears to be cell bars signed by him with like a smiley face and other fucking stupid ass shit. And it had a minimum bid of $350. As morbid as it is, I know that there needs to be a little bit of devil's advocate here. I know that there's a lot of people into different things like that. And I know like people are collectors. And, you know, at first you want to be like, oh my God, that's so fucking weird and morbid. But I also know that there are people that would be like, oh yeah, like I got this from this killer. You know, like that kind of like weird thing. It's like morbid curiosity. But I cannot imagine like getting on a site like that and actually like auctioning for it and like paying that amount of money for it. Like, I mean, if you were there and like you're like pin palling a murderer and they like draw you a picture and you keep it, that's like one thing. But like to actually go onto a site that's fucking called murderauction.com. Like, that's just on a completely different level. We need to try some therapy or something. I don't know. But that is what I have for you guys this week. I appreciate you all listening. If you would like to follow along online, see photos of the cases that we talk about, including this asshole. My Instagram is at MadsMonstersManiacs. It is spelled exactly like this podcast, just without the commas and the and. If you would like to email me any of your own stories, recommendations, or even some requests, feel free to send me an email. My email is madsmonstersmaniacs@gmail.com. I usually do reply too. So like, I don't know if you want to like email me, make me feel like I'm in 2011 again. I don't know. But thank you guys so much for listening, and I will talk to you next week.